So first of all, a huge thanks to Mark and Imogene and to all of you for this really stimulating discussion. My work and what I'm going to talk about today plays straight into these questions of identity. And I'm going to talk about the ethics of fieldwork methodology pertaining to the social context in which we work. 2 years ago, the former king of an ethnically Tibetan kingdom, Lo, which is on the border on the Chinese border in north central Nepal, requested that the community of foreign researchers who work in the area record the repertoire of Tashi Tsering, the official singer to the royal court of Lomantang, Lo's capital city. Local history describes a songbook that went missing from the king's palace years ago, and now as Tashi Tsering ages, and recreating this songbook ensures the posterity of Lo's folk song repertoire. So I assumed what I initially and naively thought of as a recording technician of sorts. I traveled to Lo in March of last year. My fieldwork among the Loba people led me to realize the complexity in which a social scientist is faced in a dynamic fieldwork setting. I entered a web of interrelated and often obscured understandings of social identity. Tashi Tsering's lineage of musicians arrived from Lomantang, from Ladakh in the 17th century, through a bribe wealth exchange between Ladakhi and Loba royalty. This musician lineage has carried with it the stigma of low-caste performers as their lineage spread from Persia to Afghanistan, to Baltistan, then to Ladakh, and finally to Lo. In Ladakh, they're called the Beda Emon and comprise an untouchable class. Because these musicians in Lomantang arrived directly from Ladakh, a brief investigation of the Ladakhi folk musicians may help to contextualize the assimilation of them, of their troops into Buddhist settings. These low-class, untouchable musicians in Ladakh were part of a joint Balti-Mughal effort to spread Islamic culture. They were integrated into Buddhist practice. Today, these musicians perform ritual offerings for the Ladakhi Buddhist cosmology that present a systematic musical and religious assimilation. Mon and Beda musicians in Ladakh have a marginalized status. They worship among Muslims and offer this music in Buddhist monasteries, but they're a part of neither social space. Their presence demonstrates the difficulties of social assimilation, serving as a hinge between these two hierarchies. They're often the so-called cause, the excuse, or the recipients of interreligious tensions and violence. While the social-religious landscape of Lomantang is perhaps not as complex, parallels can be found in the history of Lo's Beda musician lineage, their integration into Loba culture, and in the immediate present, the tension surrounding Tashi Tsering's contributions to Lomantang. The musical practices of Tashi Tsering's lineage in Lo were integrated into Loba folk and ritual settings, at local festivals and also in monasteries where the music serves as apotropaic offerings. Despite their ritual specialization, this musician lineage is also peripheralized from the community by notions of impurity that their instruments and bodies represent symbolically and literally. The musician community in Lo dwindled, and now Tashi Tsering is the sole performer who preserves these folk songs. As Tashi Tsering's health declines, the project to record his music is certainly a high level of urgency on a preservation scale. And as this talk will suggest, it bodes additional urgency beyond the confines of Lomantang. Despite the common romantic portrayal of Lomantang as the ancient walled city and the last pure outpost of Tibetan culture, the community members have both adapted to and struggled with cultural change. This was clear in my interactions with Tasi Tsering, who became increasingly conflicted to perform throughout our month of recording sessions together. His children had asked him not to play because of the stigma it suggested, and his daughter had opened up a restaurant to supplement their income. His son had found employment in an American army camp in Iraq, and while Tasi Tsering's eldest daughter teaches folk songs and dance to the village youth club, it's in a different capacity than Tasi Tsering's musical offerings, which are gender-specific. Meanwhile, other villagers and monastics continue to request Tasi Tsering's presence for various ceremonies. They believe his ritual offerings and music will bring blessings on the village and tell him that ceremonies would be complete without them, thereby making his music more than just a livelihood. It's an obligation and a meritorious act that has collective consequences, being tensions with local gods, infertility, and even insecurity for the village. So it's not surprising that Tasi Tsering often told me that he felt compromised to perform this music. Through my fieldwork, I was clearly contributing to Tasi Tsering's dilemma. During our recording sessions together, it was planting season, so there were festivals and prayer ceremonies for which the villagers requested his presence. I tried to respect Tasi Tsering's decisions of where to play on a given day, but at times he was too conflicted to decide, and on some days he'd just stay at home or in his daughter's restaurant instead of performing at all. Notions of Tasi Tsering's stigma transcended the realm of ritual to understandings of body and space in the form of impurity. Lomantang's surrounding walls divide the resident hierarchy, with the palace in the center of the village, monasteries and upper-class households radiating outwards, middle-class households on the fringes of the wall, and the low-class households are outside of the wall, outside of the agricultural fields on the riverbanks, below the plateau on which Lomantang was built. The physical layout of Lomantang is a spatialized depiction of Tibetan Buddhist identity to which Lobas adhere, wherein Tibetan Buddhists call themselves Nangchu, or insiders. It further establishes the monarchy as the cultural and historic center that provides order and sustains village cohesion. The centripetal spatial depiction is supported by the lyrical content of the songs that Tasi Tsering sang, and one such song, Gilmo Kusum, describes the Loba princess who married the Ladakhi prince that originally brought Tasi Tsering's lineage to Lomantang. It's a song that emphasizes these notions of centrality, linking distance from the village to the tragedy of detachment from the community. And it brings listeners, and myself included, to tears. The refrain states the question that Kusum asks, must you send me away? And through the verses, Kusum successively asks this question, first on the roof of the palace to the gods. And she walks downstairs to the room where the king and queen reside and asks them. Next, she climbs down another flight of stairs to the prayer room of the palace where the nobility and lamas are staying. She asks them and then leaves the palace and asks the musician who's performing offerings for her safe journey outside in the palace courtyard. Bidding her farewell at the Churton reliquary outside the village, she has one last look at Lo from atop the hills surrounding the village. And then she calls to the village one last time out of Tengri, or Mount Kailash, where she confirms that she won't be returning. As the song progresses, it creates an oral map, marking topographically locations that depict a scale of outsiderness to which the layout of the village conforms, and essentializing village centrality. So back to how this relates to Tasi Tsering. Because of his perceived stigma, perhaps my identity as an outsider too, Tasi Tsering and I were unable to record inside the Lomantang walls. Because my research colleague, Carmai Angyal, was a member of the Loba middle class, we couldn't perform in the low-class community households either, so we had to find a place outside of Lomontang's walls and above the riverbank. Both Tasi Tering's commute up to the recording space and mine from inside the village each morning gave the project a high level of exposure to locals. Elder men who congregated around the village's main entrance would tease me in the mornings and said, oh, I can sing these songs for you. Why do you need Tasi Tering to sing them? They would ask me in those moments they would discredit Tasi Tering's talent and devalue his lineage's legacy. So I realized that this project had been requested by the extreme of Lo's hierarchy. The former king and other royalty had asked researchers, and last of all, they had asked Tasi Tering. Although there was a great push by those who were connected to the research initiative to be involved with preserving this repertoire, there was ambivalence among the community members who were not involved in the research. Payment for the lengthy recording sessions further complicated matters. It legitimized Tasi Tering's performances, but by standards perceived in monetary instead of cultural terms. Lomontang sits at the cusp of the Tibetan Plateau at 3,500 meters in altitude, and it's a four-day walk to the nearest road. However, the community has been changing. Most of the community members travel to larger cities in Nepal or India to escape the winters and to supplement their income. A large population of Lobas have permanently moved to Kathmandu and beyond, and there's even a considerable community in New York City. Lomontang has historically engaged in trade with outsiders, but my exchange with them was one of a quite different nature. I was funneling money in from outside for an exchange that wasn't obviously apparent, a trade that had no immediate material value, and one that reinforced Tasi Tering's insiderness while all the privileged Lobas were moving outside. This stood in stark contrast to how Lobas themselves value, use, and circulate their own money. Many locals expressed the desire to make an income in Lo itself and saw tourism as an opportunity to do so. So they would open trekking industries and tea houses and antique shops. But attracting tourists through these is really difficult since Lomontang is the farthest flung stop on the trekking circuit. Lobas who moved outside the village funnel money in so their families can continue farming and so they can maintain their property. Simultaneously, because of the outward movement, there's a strong push for cultural preservation within the community itself. But Loba efforts prioritize their income for creating cultural and community centers and erecting monasteries in their new settlements outside of Lo. And it's the community of researchers and NGO workers who both find and implement projects for cultural preservation in Lo itself. I found my work immersed in such a dialogue. How is my research playing into Loba agency of preservation and efforts to change their own cultural practices? And why was my role even necessary? The requests for my services were those that I assume could easily be rendered by a Loba with training from outside the village. But it was probably more mired in the Loba social hierarchy than I had previously imagined. As Tasi Tering's stigma became more apparent, I witnessed his interactions with the community, and I began to question whether a request for an outsider to recreate this songbook was a method of maintaining Tasi Tering's perceived stigma. Certainly, my work allowed Lobas to value cultural information without making them directly interact with its stigmatized source. The fact that Tasi Tering has never taught his music outside of his family and the solution to endangerment of his repertoire through teaching was not even a thought, only supported my suspicion. And suddenly the king's suggestion that the songbook would allow for preservation and reinterpretation of Lo's musical practice donned a new meaning. And the bottom line was that some of the purposes of this local initiative didn't conform to Western ideals. These ideas culminated in a circumambulation festival called Chokor on the last few days of my fieldwork stay. Sometime leading up to the Chokor ritual, I realized that Lobas had switched from calling me a student and a researcher to calling me a donor, or jindag. In Tibetan Buddhism, laymen who sponsor ritual events are considered to be donors, contributing to a favorable relationship between villagers and surrounding deities. I had involuntarily, but unquestionably, become part of these cycles that uphold and maintain such relations. Such festivals in Tibetan Buddhist rural communities detail and reinforce relations with thonic beings, as well as local hierarchies. By encircling the village and fields, Chokor rituals differentiate between insiders and outsiders, order on the inside and chaos on the outside. The rituals welcome beings and deities who can bestow blessings on the village and aggressively chase away malevolent spirits. This position of jindag was complicated by my gender, as women don't usually sponsor rituals and their activity in the Chokor rituals is segregated from that of men. So in sum, the ambivalence toward my presence spoke to perceptions of change, of insiderness and outsiderness, and was a harbinger of change to come. So with that, I'll say some closing remarks and leave these ideas open for discussion. According to ethical guidelines that we as anthropologists follow, and those enforced by institutions like the American Internal Review Board, the necessary steps that we take to ensure ethical research and to protect our informants are, among others, individual agency and consent. Respect for subjects is in part the requirement to acknowledge the autonomy of them and to respect those and protect those with diminished autonomy. However, as I discovered in Lomontang, these steps don't cover the complexity a field worker must negotiate. Individual agency can be identified, but it's subject to collective pressures. And identities can't just be articulated or understood and recorded in an interview. They develop through larger temporal frames of fieldwork encounters. Permission and consent based on specific project criteria on the outset is complexified not only by issues such as literacy, but in an arena where the social conditions are constantly in flux and where the fieldwork setting is bound to change. Fieldworkers are faced with this variety of dilemmas in a live laboratory, but this by no means should immobilize our work. John Barnes has been quoted saying, "The competent fieldworker is he or she who learns to live with an uneasy conscience, but continues to be worried by it." So it's with these problems of dynamic relations, discovered changing and multiple identities, fluidity of interactions and interpretations, and understanding that we, as researchers, always need to adapt to our fieldwork setting, that I welcome your questions, insights, and suggestions. Thank you.